Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, bringing food from your local neighborhood farmer to you at West Virginia farmers markets. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Have you ever thought about the kinds of foods that your great-grandparents ate? Which ones are still around today? Does the food taste the same? Today we're going to listen back to an episode from last year about what happens when local foods go mainstream. The Appalachian Food Summit began as an online conversation between Appalachian chefs, scholars, and farmers who have a stake in the region's food culture. It grew into annual in-person gatherings of Appalachian foodies, if you will. Last year was the first time they've met in West Virginia. Let's listen to some of those who attended the 2018 Appalachian Food Summit earlier last fall. We asked people to tell us the foods they think of as traditional Appalachian cuisine.
I'm Jessica Salfia. I'm originally from Phillippi, West Virginia, but my husband and I now live in Martinsburg, which is in the eastern panhandle of West Virginia. My grandma made sausage gravy and bacon gravy, which is sausage gravy's little known little brother. And it was my favorite. And I would spend Saturday night at my mom and papa's house, and we would watch Hee Haw and eat a big bowl of popcorn. And then the next morning, breakfast was biscuits and gravy before we went to church. And it was every Saturday night and Sunday morning of my childhood. So for me, biscuits and gravy was love, and it was family, and it was all of those sweet memories you have that you get with your grandparents.
I'm personally a very big proponent of biscuits and gravy. My name is H. William Davis. You could call me Bill, that's fine. I'm from Elkins, West Virginia, originally. Every Sunday ever growing up, I spent every weekend at my grandparents, and Grandma would always make pancakes and bacon and eggs.
I'm Ed Brown, and I'm from Morgantown, West Virginia. I'm not a native Appalachian, although maybe in a way I am. I'll explain. I was born and raised in New Jersey, but we lived on a farm in southern New Jersey, in South Jersey, and South Jersey is farm country. You know, New Jersey is a garden state. So I feel like parts of New Jersey are very much Appalachian. So I grew up eating a lot of beans, because I come from a big family, a lot of beans and a lot of cornbread and, you know, greens and stuff like that. So to me, these are like comfort foods. I mean, I don't care if I ever hit the $1 million lottery, I'm still going to want to eat that food, because to me, it's just really good comfort food. So I think those foods are important. Everybody should eat them because they're healthy.
And I think it's really easy to be told that Appalachia looks like one thing, and if that's not your thing, then you're not right. You know, I am from West Virginia, but nobody else in my family is from West Virginia. And so my introduction was the food that my grandmother made, and she's from the Appalachian Pennsylvania coal fields. So, you know, it's soup beans, but it's navy beans, never cornbread. You know, she made bread rolls. But she made pepperoni rolls. So I think the pepperoni rolls for me, you know, being a West Virginian and then having that deep family connection, that's kind of my go-to.
I'm Courtney Ballester. I'm a board member of the Appalachian Food Summit.
Thanks to Ashton Mara, managing editor of 100 Days in Appalachia, for gathering those recordings. The Appalachian Food Summit last year was titled Cornbread and Roses, Solidarity, Resistance, and Subsistence in Appalachia. And as the name suggests, the two-day event wasn't just focused on celebrating foods from our region. Of course, there was plenty of food served by local Appalachian chefs, but speakers also led discussions on topics like how food intersects with politics, history, and even how food played a major role in the teacher strike in West Virginia earlier this year. Writers, chefs, scholars, and food lovers gathered in Bridgeport to talk about the role that food plays in daily life here in Appalachia. One of the organizers of the Appalachian Food Summit is farmer and chef Mike Costello. Jesse Wright spoke with Costello to find out more.
Mike Costello, welcome back. You mentioned this year that the summit's in West Virginia for the first time. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned that you have this sort of theme. Can you expand on that a little bit?
So this year we really wanted to celebrate something that has been in the news here in West Virginia, but also is just sort of so common throughout our history in Appalachia, and that's a history of solidarity, resistance, and subsistence. So that's actually sort of the official theme. You know, there's the teacher strike that happened this year in West Virginia, for instance. You know, it was all over the news. We know the results of it. We know how that inspired these movements across the country and other states, similar movements. And one of the stories that we certainly saw in the headlines from time to time, but we don't really think about after the fact, was the way that food played this really critical role in the teacher strike. First, it was sort of the governor or some of the state delegates that were sort of accusing the teachers of being so greedy, and they were making statements like, well, because of the greedy teachers, the students are starving. You know, they're not able to come to school and get the nourishment that they get every day from their lunch that's served to them. So the teachers realized that this was, you know, part of the consequence of them not being in the classroom. And, you know, I would also say that the teachers just care tremendously about their students. And you saw that when it was the teachers themselves who got together and they were putting together lunches and they were making sure that their students in need were fed throughout the strike. I think another example of this is with the West Virginia Mine Wars. Not just the Mine Wars, but, you know, if you look at even some of the more recent strikes, this was a similar phenomenon. But particularly during the Mine Wars era, because you had these communities, you had immigrants, you had some folks who had been here maybe for several generations, you had these barriers of segregation along racial or religious or ethnic lines. And, you know, the obvious strategy there on behalf of the companies was to sort of keep everyone separate and keep them from talking and keep them from organizing. But, you know, these miners, they knew that without those barriers, they would be stronger. So there are these great stories in the Mine Wars of the miners, and particularly the miners' wives, leading this communal effort to grow food together and to preserve food together. You know, they realized that the more food that they could grow and that they could preserve, the longer they could extend the strike. You know, the less they would have to rely on the companies themselves. And that gave them power and that gave them leverage.
I mean, I think all local food movements are interested in this idea of sustainability.
Right.
You know,
right.
that if your production practices are unsustainable, you know, you don't have a future.
Right.
But West Virginia especially, and I've seen this in other Appalachian states, are really interested in what we can do locally. Mm-hmm. Because the help is not coming from the outside.
Right.
You know, as much as people say it is. But there's also a pride here where you want to make do for yourself.
Right.
And Appalachians have had that pride for a long time, I think. But I see it in this local food movement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean... Mm-hmm. Am I completely off base, or is this something that
no,
concerns the Appalachian?
You're not. Concern? I mean, you know, so this is something that certainly concerns the Appalachian Food Summit. And, you know, part of that makeup of stakeholders that we talked about earlier are small farmers, chefs, you know, the people who are part of that system of trying to establish more sustainability in the kind of production stream. So, you know, it's actually, you know, it's a conversation that's not unique to Appalachia, but it is certainly one that is very relevant here because, you know, as we're talking about that idea of how we return equity and how we make sure that, you know, farmers and cooks in our region are seeing, you know, some sort of benefit from this trend, you know, we also sort of struggle with the fact that, you know, West Virginia is not a large-scale agricultural state. You know, we're sort of this hodgepodge of small farms, that this network of often really disparate farms that are spread out all over a pretty mountainous region. And, that you know, we have a lot of challenges as far as infrastructure goes to sort of get to a level of, you know, sourcing that one would maybe consider sustainable for a movement of some sorts where you're actually seeing like local food pop up in restaurants and grocery stores and whatnot. But I think that there are so many kinds of interpretations of what sustainable can kind of mean, you know? So I think to someone who operates a restaurant where they, you know, they want to be able to serve a certain volume of local food day in, day out, you know, they might look at the situation in West Virginia and they say, like, well, there's no way it will ever be sustainable because, you know, I can't, there's no farm in West Virginia that's going to grow me 300 acres of, you know, sweet corn for my busy season in the summer or something like that. But, you know, to me, I think that there's this sort of idea of sustainability that's maybe better described as food sovereignty. And it's sort of this idea that even if we don't get to this, you know, large scale where we're shipping out, you know, hundreds of pounds of produce from every small farm, there's sort of something that satisfies us and makes us feel that it's sort of worth our while and worth our time. And you know, to us, I think we're in a spot where there really is this deep kind of cultural association, and there is this deep sort of pride in our food because our food is so reflective of this culture and this place and all of these things that we're really so proud of. So, you know, I think that sort of measure is just so different from farm to farm, from cook to cook, from restaurant to restaurant about what sustainability really means. I've heard some folks, and I know some folks that are actually going to be at the summit this weekend, do a lot of work with small farmers, and they try to address a lot of these issues. And the term that they use is viability, you know, and they try to gauge from farmers, like, what makes this a viable operation? You know, is it that we just kind of keep things going or are able to pay the bills? For some of it is, you know, for some of them, that's like this important piece of their family history. It's certainly an important piece of our family history with Lost Creek Farm. You know, there's a lot of stuff that happens up there that we're involved in that we know is never going to make us a lot of money. And to an economist or to a business advisor, they would say this is not sustainable. But to us, it might be viable because there are these factors that kind of define value to us in ways other than money.
Well, Mike, thanks very much for joining us. Pleasure once again to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Listening to Mike and Jesse talk makes me think about how important food and water truly is, beyond being a basic necessity. It really makes me appreciate the folks working so hard to preserve heirloom foods in Appalachia. Let's listen back to some stories we originally aired last summer in an episode called From Shame to Acclaim, The Unlikely Path of Appalachian Food. What if I told you some of the foods that have been passed down in Appalachia date back for thousands of years and trace back to Native American culture? This next story is about a man who's been farming and collecting heirloom seeds since the 1960s. Bill Best is the author of 10 books on Appalachian culture, and his newest offering is called Kentucky Heirloom Seeds, Growing, Eating, Saving. Bill Best spoke with Roxy Todd by phone from his farm just outside of Berea, Kentucky.
Bill Best, welcome to Inside Appalachia.
Thank you.
Bill, you write in your book about traditional seed savers and why Appalachians have been saving seeds for a number of years. How did you first get started on this?
Well, I've always been started. When I was about 2 1/2, I was out picking cornfield beans with my mother. And I just grew up doing it. I never knew anything any different. We were a subsistence farm, and we grew everything that we ate. What we did have to buy, like coffee or sugar or things like this, my father would trade the eggs for. It was very little money. This was during the Depression, and everything was traded. And we would go about 5 miles downstream to a mill and have our corn ground into cornmeal. And of course, we ate cornbread 2 times a day, at dinner and at supper, and the biscuits for breakfast, usually.
Archaeologist Gwen Henderson wrote the intro to Bill's book. They met at a conference years ago. Bill remembers Henderson inviting him to a huge warehouse in Lexington, Kentucky, where they were treating seeds from a particular site.
And here I was, able to hold in my hand 1,000-year-old bean seeds that were carbonized quite a bit. But nevertheless, it was obvious to me the type of bean that they were. To archaeologists, a bean is a bean is a bean. And I was the first one to point out that the beans were being grown for different reasons during different seasons and that they had different roles in the Indian culture.
And what was that like? Were you surprised to find that these beans that your family and other people you'd met in Eastern Kentucky had been saving. Was it surprising to find out that they went back for thousands of years and connected back to Native American culture?
It wasn't surprising for the simple reason that one of my college classmates gave me one of my first beans. It had been in his family since the founding of the country, basically. And during the Revolution, one of his ancestors was a new immigrant to the country, had fought on the wrong side, and at the end of the Revolutionary War was told that he could either go back to Scotland or go into the wilds of what would be Western North Carolina. He chose to go into Western North Carolina. Not too long afterward, married an Indian woman, one of whose contributions to the marriage were some greasy beans that have been in that family since that time. And that's a long time, well over 200 years. So I was very aware of the role that the Indians had played, and some of the seeds that some of my cousins had already given me were from Indians that they were working with at that time in Western North Carolina. So it wasn't a surprise. It was more a confirmation and affirmation, I guess, that they had gone back such a long time.
Can you describe one of your favorite meals to me, one of your favorite ways to eat heirloom beans?
Cook them with fatback or ham hock. Some people put an onion in as well. And then put them on a plate. Then I crumble up cornbread on it, butter, diced onions, mix all of that up. And then I add sliced heirloom tomatoes on top of it, preferably pink tomatoes, which tend to have the more old-fashioned flavor, high in sugars and high in acids as well. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a meal fit for a king.
It sounds absolutely delicious. And it makes me wonder why meals like that have gone out of fashion. How come we don't eat these heirloom foods anymore? Does it concern you that a lot of these foods that our ancestors ate are possibly facing extinction?
It does, but I think that some of this may be coming back into fashion now, thanks to people like Ronnie Lundy, whose book Vittles talks about that a little bit. But in a talk or two that I've given recently, I have made the case that the Southern Appalachians may be one of the few places on Earth where biodiversity is actually increasing, because the same solar rays that give me skin cancers that I have to take off about once a year on average off my head and face also create mutations in the food plants as well. And I have numerous new beans that have come to me, what I sometimes call as God-given mutants, what the people in the mountains call sports. And there are literally thousands of bean varieties in the Southern Appalachians, most of which are named after women, because it was women who discovered the sports would grow them the next year to see if they bred true, and if they did, they would share them with friends and neighbors and extended family, and then typically they would assume their names later. So I'm worried about biodiversity as a whole, but certainly not in the Southern Appalachians, because I think we're doing some things for all of humanity that are typically not being done anywhere else.
You have a number of heirloom tomatoes that you've grown and heirloom tomato seeds that you've saved. And I can't let you get away without telling the story of the Vincent Watts tomato. Would you tell that?
When I first came to Berea College in 1954, Vincent Watts, who was a Berea graduate, who had then gone into the Marines for his service obligation and had come back as Associate Dean of Labor, he was an avid gardener. He was born and raised in Breathitt County, Kentucky. And his boss, Wilson Evans, from Lee County, Virginia, gave him some seeds of his family tomato that had been in his family for some generations to grow. And Wilson was wanting to try out some of the new hybrid varieties at that time, and he asked Vincent if he would mind keeping his tomato pure. And Vincent not only kept it pure, but he worked on it through his 11 or 12 years at Berea and the rest of his career at Morehead State University, 52 summers altogether before he died in 2008 at the age of 78. He worked with that Wilson Evans tomato, and it eventually became the Vincent Watts tomato. What he was doing was selecting the best plants each year, the most disease resistant, the best flavored, the best shape, the best size to save seeds from. And it is now our best-selling tomato. We've sold it for many years now since he first started giving me the seed. We'll have to add that when he died on the 15th of March, I believe, I had some of his tomato plants in my greenhouse that I was getting ready to put in my high tunnel. And so I chose the best looking, most beautiful tomato plant and potted it in a large pot and took it to the funeral home. And his two sons found a little round table and stuck it right up next to their father's face. And everybody who was doing the visitation that night knew exactly everything that that tomato had meant to him.
Bill Best is the author of a new book called Kentucky Heirloom Seeds, Growing, Eating, Saving. He's also a farmer and sells tomatoes and beans at the Lexington and Berea Farmers Markets. You can see photos of Bill's heirloom tomatoes and beans on our website. And we've also posted a longer version of this interview where he talks about why Appalachians have saved heirloom seeds more than people from other regions. He also shares the story about how he rescued a rare bean from West Virginia called the Noble Bean. That's at wvpublic.org. Next, we have a story about something that goes with beans almost as well as cornbread, the Vidalia onion.
The sweetness is unbelievable.
The onions are so sweet that you can actually eat them like an apple.
I can't imagine life without them.
I think I remember, like, you know, around 8 or 9 being aware of food enough to, like, notice that these were different than regular onions. And I think I was attracted to the name too, because it's really pretty. Vidalia.
Just in general, if I have a shirt that says Vidalia onions on it, I see them, you know, at the airport. They love it. They'll tell a story of how they first started eating them, you know, what their favorite recipe is.
I imagine Vidalia to be this mythical place. It's about an hour away from my hometown in Savannah. And I imagine that certain times of year, the soil is just sown with molasses. I don't know. It's just good.
So how did the Vidalia onion get to be so popular? Similar to the way bean seeds varied between families, farmers in Georgia had to fight to preserve the distinct flavor and branding of the Vidalia onion. From the Gravy Podcast, Tyler Pratt and Tina Antolini have the story.
Before we get much further, we should explain something about onions. They can be either hot or sweet.
When an onion is sweet, that doesn't mean that there's actually more sugar in it.
That's Tori Olson.
It means two things. It means that there's less sulfur in the onion, and it means that there's a higher water content in the onion.
Tori's an assistant professor of history at the University of Tennessee, a job that doesn't immediately make you think onions. But Tori wrote a paper about Vidalias that dug into the surprising past and contradictions of this onion industry, and he's going to be our partner in telling this story.
The things Tori mentioned that help make for a sweet onion, less sulfur, more water, they're what make a certain part of Georgia ideal for growing it.
The soil content of the southeastern coastal plain and the rainfall and the sort of climate of the region was conducive to producing a sweeter rather than a hotter onion.
But this kind of onion wasn't always grown in Georgia.
As the story goes, no one really planted onions in Georgia until the 1920s, 1930s or so.
Like all heroes, the Vidalia has its own origin myth.
And as local legend goes, this one South Georgia farmer experimented by taking a Texas onion seed and planting it in the soil of the southeastern coastal plain of Georgia, and was stunned when the onion came out not tasting hot, inducing tears or anything like that, but tasting sweeter and tasting juicier and much more sort of a palatable onion than most onions that many Americans were familiar with.
And that discovery came at a fortuitous time. The cotton industry in the South was in decline, at the same time as the Depression was worsening. Farmers in South Georgia were looking for a new crop as a potential savior.
What's fascinating is that even though, you know, according to local lore, these farmers began planting onions, it's such a small thing. I mean, we're talking about, you know, maybe 100 acres or something.
For most of the 20th century, you could only get a Georgia sweet onion if you happened to live in or visit this specific area.
If you wanted a South Georgia sweet onion, you had to drive down there and get it, basically, right? You might be able to get it at a Piggly Wiggly in southeastern Georgia, but the only other time you would get it is if you're driving through and you see farmers selling this on the side of the road.
That is, until the 1980s, when more farmers got into the onion business, including a certain farmer named Delbert Bland.
I was born in Reidsville, Georgia, which is not but 7 miles from here. I hadn't been very far, so I grew up on this farm where we're at now, and actually didn't start growing onions until we planted 5 acres in 1982. And 5 acres is probably is about half the size of this packing shed.
Delbert Bland is somewhere around 60, tall with a head of gray hair. He's a jeans and boots kind of guy with his shirt sleeves rolled up just above a gold Rolex. He likes to keep a dip in. And with that deep Georgia drawl, he paints the picture of a classic country boss. When Delbert was growing up, his father grew corn, soybeans, a little tobacco, and they raised hogs. His dad talked Delbert into staying on the farm. It was Delbert's idea to get into onions.
I got tired of chasing pigs. To be honest with you, I was wanting to see the world and get out and get somewhere besides Reidsville. I like home, but I don't want to stay there all the time, so I seen an opportunity to be growing a commodity, and the sky's the limit. You can go out and do as much as you want to do with it. And so I like the aspect of being able to market the product that we grew.
And Delbert turned out to be one heck of a marketing genius.
This here is an ad that my son, that is 37 years old now, when he was 3 years old, I run this ad in the back of Southern Living. It's got a picture of him sitting down and eating an onion.
The story goes that back in the early 1980s, Delbert put a little ad in the magazine offering 10 pounds of onions by mail for $12.95.
And my father, he just went off the deep end because he was a true farmer and he cared nothing about dealing with business. I called a lady to cancel it and she said it's too late, it's already gone to press. And show you how things work, we got 1,000 orders off of that one little old 2x4-inch ad in the back of that magazine. So I sold 1,000 10-pound bags for $12,095. And I didn't even ask my father next year, I just took out 5 ads.
Delbert decided to take it to the next level.
And I'll never forget, I guess I was around 25, 26 years old. I borrowed my mother's car and got my buddy to ride with me that grew up on the farm here with me. And I drove from here to Chicago and back down through Pittsburgh, back down through the East Coast to Georgia over 7 days.
He'd drive into a city and head straight to the warehouse where they bought onions, or the grocery store itself.
And I'd walk in the door and tell them, my name's Delbert Bland, I'm from Reidsville, Georgia. You might not can understand me the way I talk, but I got something you need. These are some very, very good onions.
Delbert would not accept defeat. He remembers fondly even the instances when he wasn't let into offices without an appointment. Like this one time when he basically did a stakeout by an onion buyer's car.
And it was almost lunchtime, so I just hung out in the parking lot waiting on this guy to come get in his car. And when he did, I stopped him. I told him who I was, and I wanted to sell him some onions. And believe it or not, that's how I started.
And the stores bought it. In fact, they lapped it up.
I think that when they seen me, a country boy come to town, can't half talk, I think they were so curious that they were just thinking, that, what is this all about?
There's something about Delbert's representation of himself, a Southern boy who talks funny but knows his onions, that's in keeping with the way they were being marketed in general. Tori Olson spent a bunch of time digging through old advertisements for the onions.
They're all sort of playing on this image of this South, this romantic rural South that's fundamentally different from, you know, industrial, urban Boston or New York or something like this. They've got images of Clark Gable from Gone with the Wind, you know, like with an onion instead of his sweetheart in his hands. They're talking about the sweet, rich soil of Georgia.
Torrey says that this moment in the 1980s was also one in which the nation was, to some degree, revising its image of the South.
This is after the civil rights movement. This is after the Klan and George Wallace are coming to mind for most of, you know, for Americans who live outside of the South as to what defines the region. And there's this sort of, you know, somewhat whitewashed, romantic, the kind of Southern living image of the American South that these Vidalia growers are absolutely latching onto and trying to sell, you know, as a sort of slow, old-fashioned, old-time, homey alternative to the industrial city in the United States.
And it worked. Delbert went from selling 10,000 pounds of onions to, say, one Chicago grocery store chain one year, to 140,000 pounds the next. The onion business was growing exponentially. There was just one problem.
The very thing that made the onion special, its sweet flavor, was also working to prevent it from being a bigger business. Remember, that sweetness comes from a low sulfur content and a high water content. Well, it turns out sulfur is a natural preservative.
And water makes something rot a lot easier. So compared to the hot onion, right, the onion that more people are familiar with, the sweet onion is a more difficult biological commodity to store and to ship because it bruises easily, it rots easily. All of the sort of things that make it special also make it very difficult to transform into something that can be shipped 1,000 miles or, you know, stored for extended periods of time.
So here were a bunch of farmers like Delbert Bland who'd gone to all this trouble to get people to fall in love with their sweet onions. And then they could only sell them for a few months of the year, the time right after they'd been harvested. Something had to be done.
Here's the, I guess, the creme de la creme in terms of onion research. This is the onion variety trial. And so where we have...
That's Cliff Reiner. He's driving me on a golf cart around several acres of little green onion sprouts. They look kinda like sparse grass. Cliff's a big guy, built like a linebacker, who knows just about everything about Vidalia onions.
He works at the Vidalia Onion and Vegetable Research Center, which is part of the University of Georgia and an ag extension for the USDA.
The biggest reason we're successful and we can kind of constantly lead the sweet onion category is our soils. So our soils are really the bread and butter.
The soils, yes. It was before Cliff's time that the onion farmers turned to the ag extension with their problems of storing sweet onions. But he knows the story.
Mr. Dole Smittle done all the background work. He'd come up here and get onions and carry them back and do actually small research in sealed 5-gallon buckets.
He was experimenting with something that apple farmers in the Pacific Northwest had come up with, controlled atmosphere storage. Basically keeping oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon dioxide, as well as temperature and humidity, at just the right levels so that the fruit wouldn't spoil.
And he finally got his recipe, and just in a short period of time after he kind of got it nailed down, there was one or two guys that started, and then all of a sudden they put up enough CA rooms, controlled atmospheric rooms, to really double their volume and then keep onions all through the summer.
These huge high-tech refrigerators were a game changer. Now they could sell onions much farther afield and for a longer amount of time. Onion sales grew and grew, based in large part on being marketed as this authentic Southern product. So you have
multi-million dollar, state-of-the-art, cutting-edge, controlled atmosphere warehouses, right, which are now beginning to dot the countryside in southeastern Georgia and are completely at odds with the image of the rural, slow, old-fashioned, backward, rural South that they're explicitly marketing their crop through, right? So it's this real contradiction of sorts.
Coming up next, we'll hear about the history behind a law that says what is and what is not a Vidalia onion, and what it has to do with Latin America. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job.
More at concord.edu.
Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, helping West Virginia farmers markets provide food harvested that morning and brought to you fresh from the farm. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
So, with this growing popularity, how did local farmers in Georgia fight to keep their local food, well, local? Let's pick back up with the next part of the Gravy Podcast to find out more.
The Georgia sweet onion's popularity, known and beloved as a uniquely South Georgia product, introduced a different problem. Imposters.
When Vidalia started, Vidalia Onion started, we didn't have no laws to govern it.
That's farmer Delbert Bland again.
And I will never forget, I got a private investigator to come down and sit in the woods to get the proof that we had people bringing onions from Texas over here, pouring them out of the Texas bag into the Vidalia bag, and selling them as Vidalias.
In the beginning, there wasn't even consensus that Vidalias is what they should be called. Vidalia is a town in this part of Georgia. It's where the warehouse was for the onions.
The farmers that lived in Glenville wanted to call it Glenville sweet onions, and the people in Vidalia wanted to call it Vidalia sweet onions because that's where the stores were.
There were a whole lot of names for basically the same thing. So a handful of the wealthier farmers decided to come together and get the state involved in trademarking a particular brand name.
I went to Atlanta, me and three or four more farmers, and we got the legislators to agree to district off the Vidalia region.
They went with the Vidalia name, and they got this state protection for it, allowing only onions grown in 20 counties in South Georgia to be called Vidalias.
Once we got the Georgia law established, we quickly realized we didn't have no authority for somebody in another state. So then we had to get a federal marketing order. So we loaded up and went to Washington, D.C.
And so they got it written into federal law. Vidalias were from South Georgia, and South Georgia only.
Was this the only place in either the United States or the world where those onions could be produced like that?
Here's Tori Olson again.
Not at all. I mean, there's plenty of places, whether it's in the Pacific Northwest or all across Central and South America, that had the same sorts of climate profiles to produce that type of onion. But that doesn't mean that South Georgia farmers aren't going to claim that this is the only place in the world where this is possible, because guess what? It sells onions, right? And that's what they want to do.
And here's where the ironies of that marketing start to get particularly intense. Remember, the Vidalia industry has this certain image of the onion that they're selling, as evocative of an old-fashioned rural South.
At the very moment, they're transforming that South into something that looks totally distinct from that romantic image, in that they're aggressively recruiting immigrant labor. They're aggressively recruiting Latino labor, and particularly coming from Mexico and from Central America.
Sweet onions are so tender, they have to be harvested by hand, which requires a lot of workers. For a long time, most of the farm labor in this part of Georgia was either Black or white.
But beginning in the 1970s, particular, you start to have a real influx of Spanish-speaking, Mexican-American, Mexican, and Central American workers coming into the region, coming into the Southeast and into the Atlantic coast that really hadn't been as present before.
But those Latin American workers found in South Georgia, the labor conditions they faced, and the visa program that governs a lot of onion workers now, well, that's complicated enough to warrant its own story. But all that is just the start of the global connections the onion industry began developing as it grew.
The thing was, there was such a demand now. Farmers wanted to be able to make Vidalias available year-round. Controlled atmosphere storage could only do so much.
So if you put an onion in a warehouse in April and you checked in mid-November to see if you can try to sell them in Thanksgiving, you'd be sorely disappointed because they would have been rotten and turned to mush and basically no one would pay any amount of money for that. Yeah, it's pretty yucky.
So they wanted to surpass the biological limitations of this onion. How do you do that? What magic trick could they come up with next?
They couldn't find a way to do that actually in Georgia. So what did they decide to do? Well, they realized essentially that there's lots of other places around the world where you can grow sweet onions that have a similar soil and climate and precipitation profile to southeastern Georgia.
It was actually the Ag Extension Service in combination with USAID, the federal agency in charge of international development, that helped figure out where in the world to turn.
So the bridge from the United States, from Southeast Georgia to first Nicaragua and then Peru, is constructed not by free market entrepreneurs, but by government bureaucrats.
First, they tried Nicaragua, but had issues with too much rain. So they started looking for another Latin American country. Delbert Bland has his own story of how he learned about this new frontier for growing onions.
This guy from Peru, boy, went to school in UC Davis in California and graduated with an agriculture degree. He toured the U.S. on his way home, ended up here looking for things that they could grow in Peru.
His name was Carlos.
And so he rode around with my father for a couple of days in the truck because Daddy wouldn't sit down and talk to nobody. He just stayed in his truck all day. And he took a liking to this little fella. And when he went to leave, he gave him a bag of onion seed. It's about the size of a little mustard seed to put in his suitcase and carry home.
So in Delbert's version of the story, Carlos went home and started playing around with growing the onions in Peru.
And through working with him, we figured out that we could grow those onions down there and they would be just as sweet in the desert, basically, down there. And then it comes off at the opposite time of the year that the vidayas do. So that's basically how we started, by accident. And that's how most things start, really.
That's the legend, according to Delbert. The reality, well, it's a little less folksy charming. We learned it from Carlos himself. We tracked him down by phone in Peru.
My last name is Lozada, L-O-Z-A-D-A.
According to Carlos, by the time he visited South Georgia, he was already very familiar with sweet onions. Peru is traditionally a red onion growing country. But in the early 1990s, they'd had a visit from a U.S. delegation aimed at introducing them to agricultural products they could sell in the United States.
One such expert mentioned the possibility of growing sweet onions. Since we already had expertise growing onions, it seemed natural for us to give it a try with those sweet onions.
His first visit to South Georgia came on the heels of some sweet onions he'd grown, which were being distributed from there. But he did meet and strike up a friendship with Raymond Bland, Delbert's father.
And he was very kind and showed me the farm around. Actually, I had a hard time understanding him. His way of speaking was very strange for me. It was because of his strong Southern Georgia accent. But with the time, I got used to it.
Raymond did give Carlos some seeds to try in Peru, a new variety, other than the kind that he was already growing. And the Blands went into business with Carlos, though they parted ways years ago. The friendship has endured, even after Raymond Bland's passing. And sweet onions are now a big business in Peru. Carlos says something like 8,000 acres are grown there now.
Now, in our supermarket, you also find the sweet onions, the yellow sweet onions, that were not known before we started growing for the U.S.
So they're now eating sweet onions in Peru. They've had to figure out some new dishes to use them in, though.
It is not good to eat a ceviche with yellow sweet onions.
Back at Bland Farms, all these internationally grown onions still come through the packing houses in South Georgia.
Delbert Bland and I are standing in the middle of his huge open-air warehouse. It's massive. And it's just one of five facilities Delbert has in the area. Forklifts carrying huge bins whiz by. And that loud noise? Those are several different roller coasters of onion machinery going all at once.
So from August back around to February, we grow the onions in Peru and we import them and pack them out of here. And then we ship from Mexico starting in March. And then we go to Texas the first part of April. And then we come back to Georgia the latter part of April to start back with vidayas. And that makes your cycle.
Onions. Thousands of onions. They bounce around and go up one conveyor belt and roll down another. Sorted and categorized, they end up in either bags, boxes, crates, or bins. Each is meant for a different destination, somewhere in North America. Delbert says his business is now worth just shy of $100 million.
Here's the final irony, though. Remember all that effort farmers put into securing a law that said you could only call onions grown in Georgia Vidalias? Now that they've branched out into Peru and Mexico, they can't call their own onions Vidalias.
You have to grow them here to call them a Vidalia. When we leave the Vidalia region and go to Peru, we actually grow the same onion seed and the same varieties in Peru, but we don't call them Vidalias. We just call them Peru sweet onions.
Take a look in the grocery store right now, during the winter, for sweet onions. Tori Olson says you might see the familiar Bland Farms logo.
They'll taste exactly the same, and you'll think they're exactly the same, but these are not Vidalia onions at all. These are Peruvian onions that just happen to be marketed and packaged by the same growers that are selling actual Vidalia onions. And it's disingenuous in some ways, but it's also brilliant in others.
The Vidalia onion industry as a whole has been very skillful at navigating all of the twists and turns of technology, government wrangling, and global commerce. But does this globalized onion industry mean that they've let go of their southern down-home image? Not at all.
They've doubled down on it, right? So all the same sorts of mythical stereotypes that were used to market this crop are only stronger today. You know, that it's this regional crop grown by small southern farmers and doing what they love in the soil that they call home. Well, you know, that's a good marketing message, but it's completely at odds with how this product is produced, whether in Georgia or in Peru, obviously.
That was food historian Tori Olson, an assistant professor of history at the University of Tennessee. His first book, Agrarian Crossings, Reformers and the Remaking of the U.S. and Mexican Countryside, will be published by Princeton University Press this summer. That story was produced by Tyler Pret and Tini Antolini for the Gravy Podcast, a project of the Southern Foodways Alliance. You know, it seems like every few years or so, Appalachian food gets rediscovered by mainstream media as an up-and-coming culinary trend. But how does this attention affect Appalachians? WFPL's Ashley Stevens has more.
When she was in her 20s, Appalachian-born food writer Ronnie Lundy worked in a community garden in New Mexico. She remembers one day in particular when she was separated from her fellow gardeners, two young women from California, by a row of plants. Though she could distinctly hear every word they were saying.
I remember hearing one of the girls say to the other one, "Oh my God, do you know what they do to lettuce in the South? They pour bacon grease on it. Ugh, gag. Oh my God, how awful." And they were laughing. And I remember being in the other part of the garden and first of all, feeling the shame.
But then Lundy thought,
I've had that, and it's really good. You don't know what you're talking about.
40 years later, something in that old dynamic has shifted. Appalachian food has been discovered by critics and eaters alike as trendy regional cuisine prime for reinvention. But advocates for the region, like Lundy, point out that many of the dishes now popping up on mainstream menus have been used in the past as a way to shame residents of Appalachia, based on their perceived socioeconomic status or class. It's a complicated phenomenon, not mentioned on the trend lists. One that shines a spotlight on how dominant urban communities truly make the decisions about what and when certain regional foodways become nationally accepted. This urban-rural divide is nothing new. According to University of Kentucky professor of rural sociology Julie Zimmerman, it's been slowly deepening since 1920. That was the first year census data showed the U.S. population tipped a little bit more urban than rural. And while Zimmerman cautions no two rural communities are exactly the same,
rural Mississippi is not the same as rural Massachusetts.
She does say one challenge many face is the homogenized negative portrayal of rural areas.
Not just flyover country, but as being backwards, stuck in the past.
She says this can cause some people who move to urban areas to feel they have to hide their roots, a process of assimilation that could range from losing one's accent to giving up the foods of one's childhood. That's how Brooke Jenkins Howard used to feel about deer meat. Now she can often find it at the Whole Foods in Lexington. Jenkins Howard was raised in Appalachia, but moved to Lexington for college.
I remember that people were disgusted by the fact that, you know, we might have deer or venison, if you want to be proper. But I remember that being such a culturally specific thing that they, you know, were from a city and they didn't have that as part of their diet. And they were kind of snobby about it.
In the years that have passed, venison has become more generally accepted and even kind of mainstream. Venison's evolution is similar to what happened to foods like crawfish and catfish. They were once so-called trash foods that got culturally upgraded once they became popular.
The elite white diners had to redefine the food to justify eating it.
Kentucky-born writer Chris Offutt explored the concept in his essay, Trash Food.
Otherwise, they were voluntarily lowering their own social status, something nobody wants to do.
But as these Appalachian foods, delicacies like grits and ramps, move into the mainstream, Ronnie Lundy says it's important to remember there's a backstory. And for many, these foods are dredged in decades of social lessons about class and place.
It would be great if everybody went, hey, Appalachian food is really hot. Let's go find out everything we can about how to make it authentically, and let's see if we can turn this into economic booster for the region, you know, because we need it.
But, she says, telling the whole story of Appalachian food and how it relates to people and place is a mission that needs to continue, even once that national appetite for the cuisine dims. I'm Ashley Stevens in Louisville.
You know, I loved pinto beans so much as a kid that I called them chocolate beans, and it's still one of my favorite meals. I've gotten some funny looks when I shared my love for the protein-packed meal. The looks and laughter made me wonder what was wrong with eating beans, so I didn't talk about it much for a while. Then I realized just how much folks miss out by not eating beans. You know, it's nice to have all these fancy restaurants recognizing just how tasty Appalachian food can be, but it's a shame that it wasn't considered quite as tasty when the food was coming out of the hills and hollers of Appalachia. No matter what they cook in places like New York or Los Angeles, there's nothing like a ramp grown right here in the hills of West Virginia. Till next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Marisa Anderson, Dinosaur Burps, Andy Agnew Jr., and Ben Townsend. Our Appetite Appalachia theme music is by the Carolina Sunshine Trio. Roxy Todd is our co-producer. Jesse Wright is our executive producer. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Claire Hemme also helped produce. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.